It's the takeaway, folks. The demonstrators stand firm in Cairo. The government digs in. The Egyptian army enforces a kind of peace in an urban stalemate in Cairo with global implications this morning. Good morning once again. We are taking a look at the situation in the Middle East and the confused sort of situation about what happens next. Will tomorrow come in Cairo? A full discussion. Let's begin with Nicholas Kristof, as we usually do, columnist for our partner, The New York Times, who has been following the situation this morning regarding casualties. There is a casualty count of what happened overnight, which was much more violent than we've seen. There was an apology from the prime minister of Egypt this morning and a call for an investigation into the casualties. Nicholas Kristof, you're doing something of an investigation into the kinds of casualties we've seen yourself. What are you seeing?
Tahrir, and right now I'm at a field hospital, and I mean, boy, just the determination of people to keep on resisting the outrage from the attacks yesterday is just palpable here. There are 150 doctors who have volunteered at this field hospital to help. I just ran into a doctor who lives 200 kilometers away, and after he saw images on satellite television of the protesters being attacked by these Mubarak thugs, he made his will and then drove here to be here to treat the wounded. And I met one young man who his leg is in a cast, his arm is in a sling, he's got wounds all over his head, he's just being treated for a head wound, and each time he goes back out to the front lines to fight for SECs, for democracy. Just the determination is unbelievable.
And Nicholas Kristof, this is a field hospital. This is would be in addition to whatever sort of medical facilities are actually normally available in Cairo, correct?
That's correct. This is a mosque that has been turned into a clinic. It's within Tahrir. I mean, one of the problems is that, you know, Tahrir is still surrounded in a lot of areas by these Mubarak thugs carrying clubs with nails driven in them, and in other places by the army, who are to some degree trying to seal off Tahrir. So this is a little mosque that has been turned into a field hospital.
Well, let's explore this. You've got a doctor who drove 200 kilometers to get there. You've got a field hospital operating in the middle of Tahrir Square. Presumably to function, they're going to have to get medical supplies from other institutions within Cairo. That implies other people in Cairo are cooperating to help the demonstrators out. Is that your sense?
I asked about supplies, and they've been getting supplies all morning. They say they're quite well supplied. There was one vehicle bringing supplies that was caught by the Mubarak thugs, and it was its windows were broken and all the medical supplies destroyed. But others have been getting through.
There you can. Go ahead, Nick.
I asked the doctor about a blood bank. I said, is there a blood bank here? And he said, oh, no, that the young people come here to shed blood, not to get it.
Wow. Nicholas Kristof, columnist for our partner, The New York Times, describing the details and the mechanics of solidarity of the people supporting the demonstrators. Samer Shahata, assistant professor of Arab politics at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies at Georgetown University. Does what Nicholas Kristof describes here surprise you at all? And how long can this go on if the support continues to stream in?
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me in a bit. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of solidarity throughout the country, throughout the Arab world, and even beyond now with what we've been seeing in Cairo and other cities, I mean, many other cities, not just Cairo, in terms of protesters that are calling for the immediate, not only resignation, but departure of Mr. Mubarak. And I think something else that Mr. Kristof said needs to be made very clear to your listeners and to some of the people who are watching. This is not what we saw last night in Cairo, is not a battle between pro-Mubarak protesters and protesters that are anti-Mubarak. All of us who study Egypt saw yesterday as the tried and true method of the Egyptian government. I mean, this is standard operating procedure. They hire thugs for hire. They have police people who are in plain clothes, and they regularly deploy them at certain times in the past. Whenever there are protests or demonstrations, peaceful protests and demonstrations, they put those people, the plainclothes ones and the thugs, on the front lines ahead of the security forces at times of elections. In 2010, just a month ago when I was there, I saw this for those elections, the parliamentary elections. In 2005, I was there also, and they did it as well. They used them to intimidate intimidate voters, to intimidate candidates, and so on. It's a way that they can use coercion and violence against civilians without being implicated by the state. In other words, the state's fingerprints, the government's fingerprints, aren't on the violence. So I think that needs to be made immediately clear. But your point about the level of solidarity and enthusiasm, it is all over the place. You know, people from all walks of life now have joined in solidarity with these protesters, people who had never been politicized before in their lives.
Summer, let me ask you, we're seeing signs this morning that the Army is perhaps taking sides with the protesters. They've moved in between the two sides and have cleared pro-Mubarak supporters out of Tahrir Square. And we've also heard reports that they perhaps could be a military coup coming. Should that happen, does that take power away from the people who have felt empowered throughout this uprising?
Right. 2 points. With regard to the Army, you know, I would be a little bit hesitant with regard to a characterization of the role, because what we saw, unfortunately, yesterday morning in Cairo is the Army permitting or allowing or not preventing the pro-Mubarak thugs, the thugs for hire, the horse riders that wanted to stampeded into the crowd, the camel riders that stampeded into the crowd with whips, the people who went on top of buildings, 8 and 9 and 10 story buildings in around the Maidan, around Tahrir Square, who were throwing rocks and other objects from above at the protesters. So with regard to that, yesterday at least, the Army wasn't being exactly neutral. They were allowing this to happen.
Right.
Then with regard to today, it's obviously a good thing that they've stopped this. But again, I think many of us who study the Egyptian regime have lost all faith in its credibility. We don't know. The prime minister, the new prime minister, apologized today for the violence and so on. And again, you know, that really does, that seems to be another part of the strategy. You see, there's a PR strategy, there's a political strategy, but there's also a violence strategy and a coercive strategy, just as there is an information strategy with the blocking of the internet. Now we've heard that Vodafone, one of the carriers in Egypt, the mobile phone carriers, is being ordered to send pro-Mubarak SMS messages to all of their subscribers.
An arsenal of weapons in this war of information, as well as the war on the streets. Samer Shahada is assistant professor of Arab politics at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies at Georgetown University. Our coverage continues.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.